It's Muppeturgy, and hold on to your tiaras because we're here to discuss the Linda Carter episode of The Muppet Show.
Yay!
Hey everyone, welcome back. I'm so glad you're here with us. I'm David Levy, and here today with me are...
Christy Bauer.
Michal Richardson.
And Adam Grossworth.
Listen, everybody, I'm sorry, but I have a very embarrassing announcement to make.
So, in the Jonathan Winters episode, I told a fairly self-incriminating story about the Westwood Cemetery in Los Angeles, and was so excited to tell this story that I referred to Bob Crane, Hogan of Hogan's Heroes, as Robert Crane. I was going to make a that's his father joke, but his father's name was like Albert or Alfred or something. His full legal name was Robert, but
I was going to say,
even on his headstone, it said Bob Crane. So
for this, we do a correction.
I regret the error.
We are nothing if not pedantic, and it is
exactly
important to get things
exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We get things right, and the man's name was Bob Crane.
Here is a Muppet News flash.
This week, we are talking about Season 4, Episode 19 of The Muppet Show. It was produced the week of January 29th, 1980, and it aired in New York on February 18th, 1980. It was number 15 in the air order between Christopher Reeve and Mark Hamill.
What a place to be.
I was trying to figure out a way to do that.
No, you're not. I'm actually just surprised that, all of these episodes that we've covered the last few weeks have aired so quickly, or did air so quickly, and that Christopher Reeve and Linda Carter were next to each other for reasons we will get into, I'm sure. But what a great run of episodes. Spoiler. In the news, on February 18th, 1980, Trudeau favored by a wide margin over Clark as Canada votes today. This is not the current Prime Minister of Canada, but I believe his father.
Yes, who dated Barbara Streisand quite
there
famously.
You go.
Wow.
And I can now confirm that this is what the New York Times does. It's Trudeau and Reagan and Carter and Mrs. Thatcher and Mrs. Gandhi. And I hate it. The Russians have won the gold medal in pairs figure skating at the Olympics, at which there are enormous crowds, which are actually creating a problem for the very small town of Lake Placid, New York. And like people are having trouble getting to the Olympics from where they make them park. It's a whole thing. It's just an ad that amuse me. Final markdowns at Antarax sheepskin shops. All sheepskin coats, half price, which both feels extremely late 70s, early 80s, and connects nicely to this episode.
Timely.
Flood dampens notions of an ever dry phoenix. When Peggy and Martin Bishop pulled up stakes in northern Wisconsin last fall to move to a retirement village near here, they were apprehensive about Arizona's water problems. We'd read a lot about how too many people were moving to Arizona and they were running out of water, Mr. Bishop said. Well, after the past 3 days, I'll never believe what I read in the papers again. This is just like been a run of really good quotes from randos in the New York Times. and I admit I don't really read the New York Times currently, except for like their theater coverage. So I don't know if they still do this, but this feels like also very much a thing of its time where they
Days they only run quotes from Republican operatives, but they don't tell you that they're Republican operatives. They pretend that they're randos.
Great. Well, maybe one of them will have their breakdown soon.
But they seem to be running a lot of stories about how too many people are moving to Colorado or too many people are moving to Arizona.
Right. Which is not actually what the story is about. It's about the fact that even in the desert, you can have flooding, sort of especially in the desert, you can have flooding because the ground is very dry and doesn't soak up the water properly when something happens. Computer builds up city's bookkeeping reputation. This is a new computer system that was just installed by the city of New York. It is operated and maintained by more than 300 city employees. Here's a wonderful quote. Last summer, one official sought to put through pay authorizations for new employees, but was turned away because the system was tied up with the time-consuming effort to close out the city books for the previous year. The checks were delayed.
Oops.
Like, I know this was actually a huge deal. It was high-tech. It was like a whole thing, but it's just wild to think about as we sit here recording this podcast in our homes. There's an article about the Museum of Modern Art in New York putting ads in buses with postcards of the art that you can tear off and take away, which is kind of neat, and also reminded me of the late 90s and early 2000s where every store and restaurant had a rack of free postcards with ads on them.
I love that.
I loved it too. Yeah.
Forgot that those don't exist anymore until you mentioned them.
I feel like I still see them occasionally, but yeah, I wallpapered the entryway of my old apartment that I lived in from 1997 to 2001 with those postcards. It was fun until I had to take them down. Prince is the name that a 19-year-old rock composer, singer, and instrumentalist from Minneapolis calls himself. With two albums and a hit single to his credit, which were essentially sole efforts, Prince producing and playing all the instruments, he has now assembled a touring band and appeared at the Bottom Line on Friday and Saturday evenings. I feel like reviews of random club gigs by basically unknown artists is also not a thing that the New York Times... I don't think they do reviews of concerts, of like pop and rock concerts at all. Also, this... I don't actually know what Prince sounded like in 1980, but this reviewer is an idiot.
Also, Prince is the name that his parents called him.
Also that. Yeah, also it's his actual name.
I mean, but he had two albums and a hit single at this point, so it's not like this is some random guy at a club.
Sure.
Yeah, starting a sentence with Prince is the name.
Right.
And I am sorry to report that John Denver shot a neighbor's dog with a BB gun.
Nope.
I need a song lyric to follow that up.
Well, you're not going to get one. You are going to get... Denver said he fired at the animal because it and another dog were giving my little dog a hard time. No charges filed because there was no evidence that Denver had intended to hurt the dog. He just said that he shot it on purpose.
Well, you might have been trying to aim away from it just to scare it away.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not saying I want John Denver to go to prison, but I don't want him to shoot dogs either.
No,
well,
but I
have
want
good
him...
news for you on the likelihood of John Denver going to prison front.
Don't want John Denver to have gone to prison.
I don't want that, but I want him to have played the dentist. Like, I'm hearing he shot a neighbor's dog with a BB gun as the dentist in Little Shop.
Yeah, that's fair. Bad casting, but fair.
Oh, it would have been terrible, but it would have been fun for me.
In theater, a couple interesting articles. There's a feature on Mumenschantz, whose show has been running on Broadway for 3 years.
Are they doing eight shows a week?
I don't know.
I just can't. Like, who is the audience?
I mean, I was. We've established that I saw this thing, but three
once,
years?
But 3 years, like, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, wild.
Are we sure they weren't just like standing on Broadway?
Well, no, they were running.
They've been running on Broadway. Just circles around Duffy Square.
Up and down,
just
yeah.
Laps. Yeah.
Just weird nonsense.
Yeah. Theaters are starting to aid the deaf. This is an article about the first infrared listening devices in two Broadway houses, which, you know, are now completely ubiquitous and have not really changed technologically in 40 something years. And also sign interpreters at the Chelsea Theater Center, which no longer exists. And I think might now be the Westbeth, but I'm not sure. If you Google Chelsea Theater Center, Westbeth comes up. So. On the Cashbox pop charts, the number one song is Cruisin' by Smokey Robinson. And I looked because I was curious. Prince's I Wanna Be Your Lover was at number 16. And the number one album is Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Still The Wall.
Was Cruisin' a new song in 1980?
Couldn't tell you. Could just tell you it was number one.
I think so.
Do you want to look it up? Do you want to pause?
I was curious.
Maybe it was climbing the charts for a year, two.
Or it was like in a movie soundtrack or something.
It feels like an old song. It released 1979.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, feels like an old song because we are old.
Right.
This is 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it doesn't feel like a Smokey Robinson song to me. Like, right. I'm always surprised to hear that. In television, there's an article about the many new talk shows coming in the fall from the likes of John Davidson, Tony Tennille, Jerry Van Dyke, F. Lee Bailey, Bert Convy, and Vidal Sassoon, which sounds like that bit from Hedwig. To me, John Davidson, Tony Tennille, Jerry Van Dyke, F. Lee Bailey, who is actually an American working in the Canadian. couldn't resist my terrible accent. Mm-hmm. CBS, WKRP in Cincinnati, The Last Resort, MASH. During a hectic nonstop rush of wounded that is overcrowding the camp, the staff's brief naps have disturbing dreams in which the war is a never-ending intrusion.
Oh, I think I also remember this episode.
Yeah, I remembered this when I read it, and this also has the dreaded words written and directed by Alan Alda. It is like a legendarily cringy episode of a generally good TV show. I tried to watch it today and lasted all of 5 minutes before turning it off, but I did confirm it was the one I was thinking of, so that's your fact-checking for you for this week. That was followed by House Calls and Lou Grant. ABC had All-Star Family Feud with the casts of Angie, The Ropers, Dukes of Hazzard, and The Waltons, competing for cash prizes to be donated for charity, and the Olympics. NBC had Little House and Part 2 of The Towering Inferno. PBS had another edition of the American Short Story series that we've talked about. This was James Thurber's The Greatest Man in the World. And I was just struck by the description in the ad. Jack Smirch, fortified by a gallon of gin and a salami, became the first man to fly nonstop around the world. He received worldwide acclaim, yet success didn't spoil him. He remained the arrogant, overbearing, all-around nitwit he always was.
Unlike the salami, which probably did spoil by the end.
Well, it's a cured meat. Cured of what? We may never know. There's an ad for HBO, and this is the first mention of HBO that I think we've seen. It's not even in the TV listings yet. And the ad is for a show called Consumer Reports Presents The Food Show.
Okay.
So we've come a long way in terms of cable TV.
And we have a fantastic show for you tonight, because our very special guest is that lovely star of television's Wonder Woman, Miss Linda Carter. Yes!
Linda Carter, actress, singer, icon. Linda Jean Cordova Carter was born in 1951 in Arizona. A performer from a young age, she made her TV debut on a local talent contest program when she was 5 years old, and she sang and played in bands as a teenager, including one that did well enough to get a three-month gig in Vegas playing the Sahara. When she was 19, she got a job touring with the Garfin Gathering, a band that toured primarily in Nevada. She stayed with them for 2 years before deciding to leave to pursue acting. She entered the pageant circuit and won Miss World USA in 1972, reaching the top 15 in the Miss World pageant that year. From there, she was able to move to Los Angeles to take acting classes and begin working professionally, with small roles on television and in mostly forgotten films. Her big break came in 1975 when she was cast as Wonder Woman for a new ABC television series. The show ran for 3 seasons, moving to CBS and shifting its setting from World War II to the present day for seasons 2 and 3, when it was known as The New Adventures of Wonder Woman. For some reason, if you watch it on Max, they have split it up into 4 seasons, but that is fake. It was actually 3 seasons. I don't know what's going on there. During her time on Wonder Woman, Carter married her former agent, Ron Samuels. With her newfound fame on television, she also became a spokesperson for brands such as Maybelline and Diet 7-Up. She continued to perform and record music, headlining at Caesar's Palace and releasing the album Portrait in 1978. In 1979, she headlined a television special with Muppet Show guest stars Leo Sayer and Kenny Rogers. This is more or less where she's at when she appears on The Muppet Show. Wonder Woman had just concluded, and she's increasingly shifting her focus to music. She would host more television specials, including 1981's Celebration, which was CBS's highest-rated show of the year and which won an Emmy Award. In 1982, she and her husband ended their marriage, and 2 years later, she married Robert A. Altman, not the film director, but a lawyer who later co-founded a video game holding company, which I learned means that's a company that exists to buy up other companies. So he owned the company that bought a bunch of other video game companies. It would eventually itself be bought up by Microsoft. Carter left Hollywood for the greater Washington, D.C. area in the mid-80s, and she and Robert had 2 children. Meanwhile, she continued to work, primarily in TV movies and in voiceover. In the late 90s, she entered rehab for alcoholism, and since then, she has been a spokesperson offering hope of recovery to others who struggle with addiction. In this century, she's appeared in films like Super Troopers, The Dukes of Hazzard, Sky High, and Wonder Woman 84. She's lent her voice to a number of games in the Elder Scrolls series, which were produced by a company owned by her husband. And I think her son was also one of the creators or producers or somehow involved in the creation of those games. She played the role of Mama Morton in the West End production of Chicago in 2005, and she toured a club act in 2007. In 2009, she finally recorded her second album, At Last, which reached number 10 on the Billboard Jazz Charts. She has subsequently released additional albums, including an EP of songs she wrote and performed for the video game Fallout 4. Carter has been an advocate for a number of causes, including abortion rights, LGBT equality, and healthcare advocacy related to irritable bowel syndrome and breast cancer. In the social media age, she has been embraced by a new generation of fans as an accessible icon with good politics. Once Twitter started going downhill, Linda moved over to Tumblr, where she still has an active presence. Carter's husband died in 2021, a loss she is still mourning. A couple of months ago, she released a single called Letters from Earth that is a tribute to him. Does anyone have Linda Carter memories that you would like to share?
Just a general awareness that she was Wonder Woman, and that was nice.
Yeah, ditto. That's all I get.
This is both an age difference thing and like a monoculture thing, right? I don't have clear memories of Wonder Woman, but I'm sure I must have watched it. I'm shocked it only ran for 3 seasons. And I looked it up while you were talking. It was only 60 episodes. So I don't even know if it was syndicated, because I would have been like a little young for it. But I definitely like had friends who were super into it. it was around. And, like, she's definitely one of those people who, as a, you know, 4 or 5 year old, like, I fully knew both the actor's name and of Wonder Woman because of this TV show, and thought she was great. I still think she's pretty great.
The show did have a second wind around the turn of the century when all of a sudden there were like 100 cable channels that needed content. And
sure.
And it got snapped up, I think, by Sci-Fi or one of those.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched it. I've watched a couple episodes for the podcast. It's come up a couple times and they're real dull. But
yeah, when everything was coming out on DVD, I snapped up all 3 seasons and tried to watch. And I've maybe seen 2 or 3 episodes since then because it's not good.
Yeah. But she's great. I mean, she is, even when the show is not good, she is great on it. And like,
and the fashions, especially in the latter 2 seasons when it takes place in the 70s, are delightful.
Yeah. I mean, even like, especially like you compare it to now, like the costume, and this is true for Superman to a lesser extent, is terrible. Like it doesn't fit her well. It's just like, you can tell how cheap the fabric is. You know, it's just, I mean, we've gone like into full, you know, plastic and plus CGI bodysuits, but still, like, it's a wild thing. David, what did you think of the episode?
What a great episode. This is one that I've definitely seen a number of times over the years. Almost every song, every sketch, every beat was familiar to me. And with good reason. It's just, it's great. There's not a single moment that I can say brought it down. It may not be one of my absolute favorite episodes, but very solid. I would strongly recommend to anyone who has an affinity for superheroes and the Muppets.
Michal?
I agree. And also, so this was a fun episode of The Muppet Show. It was a really impressive technical achievement. There was a lot that they built for this episode that was really cool and really fun to look at. And Linda Carter is delightful. And then maybe it's because I was so focused on the backstage plot and trying to figure out what to sum up about it, even though not much happens. There's something about the tone and the writing of this episode that struck me as a little odd. It felt kind of weirdly paced. There were some moments where it felt like there were beats that were just kind of missing, like in a Valentine show kind of way. They set up a plot and then it doesn't go anywhere. Like Ocean Breeze soap. So this is like a season 4B. Like it's still very good. It's still very funny. And there's a lot of cool stuff in it, including some really iconic moments. And then it's just a little odd, but I would still highly recommend it.
Christy?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think it's a good time. I think Linda Carter is charming and game and a fun presence with and without the Muppets. But there's just something about it that sort of goes down a little too smooth. I wanted something and I can't put my finger on it. And maybe by the time we get to the end of this discussion, I can figure it out.
I see all of that. It's my new number 5. I love this episode so much.
Displaced JP.
It did. And I frankly might be ranking Gilda Radner a little too high. It's something David brought up recently about the songs, right? Every song in this. Well, there's one that I don't really care about, but I mean, all these songs are great. And they're also things that have stuck with me. I don't know when the last time I saw this was. I mean, it has to have been at least 20 years, but like so many core memories, like the second every sketch started pretty much, I was like, oh, it's this one. It's this one. This is the only way thing I know this song from is this. And I had even conflated a couple things with both like 2 things in the episode and something that we haven't watched yet that's in a couple weeks, and I had like smushed them all in my memory into one thing, and now I'm sort of delighted that I have something to look forward to for the other piece of it that we haven't seen yet. I don't know, I love this. I love her. I think it's great.
Linda Carter.
I know Scoots, it's 20 seconds to curtain.
Scoots,
you can read my mind.
I'm not reading your mind, I'm reading my script.
Huh? Oh, no, no. Kermit wouldn't allow a script on this show. Everything we say on here is ad-lib.
Yeah, so not only is Kermit bad at his job, he also tries to have some kind of integrity about making sure that he does a bad job by not allowing a script. I don't know, that indignation of like, oh, Kermit would never. We couldn't possibly have a script.
We also know it's not true.
Right. I mean, there is a script. And also, we learned from the talk spot in the Rita Moreno episode way back in season 1 that they're all reading off of cue cards, even during the talk spot.
I just need to go back to the fact that she called him Scoots.
Scoots. And which was either ad-libbed or scripted. Take your pick. Scoots. Yeah, so Statler and Waldorf were just leaving.
Don't start! We haven't left yet!
No.
So this was a super weird moment because I know it's only like 3 seconds long, but the pacing is really off. Like, they sit there while the vamp plays for what feels like an uncomfortably long time before they do their
sway
bit.
In unison, and it's really cute.
Right, but it. But why?
But
are
why would they do that
if they're trying to leave? Like, it just. I think this goes to what you were saying before about like there's something off about the pacing of the whole episode, and this is the first hint of that.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of what they were doing, they were probably just like playing around until somebody cued them to start, and then that got included, even though it shouldn't have.
Right, but like if the editor of the episode should have instead had them laugh longer, cut the beginning, run the laugh longer, but you know.
Yeah, and maybe the bits that we'll talk about were more of an editing problem than a writing problem. There was use of a lot of different shots and a lot of different extra moments in a way that didn't make sense. So maybe this is the editor's fault. Anyway, Gonzo horrifies us right from the get-go. He blows this brilliant brassy note. Good for you, Gonzo. And then he takes the trumpet out of his mouth and there's a set of teeth attached to it. It's a whole set of chompers just clinging to that thing that came out of Gonzo's face. Even though Gonzo has never had teeth before.
Whose teeth are they?
Although he's told us before that he blew his teeth out of the trumpet.
God. Oh, that's true. It did. I did not clip it, but it's not just a horrifying image, but there is a sound that goes with it.
Oh, yeah. It just like slurps out of his mouth.
Oh, God. It's so awful.
This was the worst 10 seconds of the entire series of The Muppet Show. It's not even 10 seconds long, but whatever it is the worst of it.
Just that sound.
Yeah. Maybe I'm going to bump this episode down to 7 or 8 just based on that.
Yeah, points deduction for Gonzo's teeth.
I did make a GIF because, you know, it's what we do, but
hey, but you didn't like it. Let's go backstage.
The Muppet Show backstage.
So this week on The Muppet Show, Linda Carter is here. And the Muppets are here, too.
You forgot to mention the sketch I am in.
Well, I didn't forget. I just didn't think it was important.
You didn't.
It's important, but not that important.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's not like it was a matter of life and death.
You're sure about that?
Ladies and gentlemen, later on in the show, our own Miss Piggy here will be portraying a brand new character, Wonder Pig.
Wonder Pig?
That's the other thing I would deduct points for in this episode, is that Linda Carter is in the wings a couple of times after Kermit announces Wonder Pig, and she just like seems really skeptical that Piggy can pull it off.
It's also weird because they do it twice and it's the same beat both times, and it's not really a joke and it's not really a running gag, and it brings back the editing point where like I feel like they shot two versions of it and should have only used one, but they both wound up in there for some reason.
Maybe. But yeah, she does not seem very confident in Piggy's abilities, and I do not appreciate that. She's great later.
I don't think this is about Piggy's ability. I think it's about, like, that seems like a tacky takeoff on my thing.
There's an interesting, especially to compare this to the Christopher Reeve episode, which embraced his Superman-ness without putting him in costume, and the Mark Hamill episode, which fully had him play Luke Skywalker, that it comes up a couple times that Linda Carter is not interested in doing a Wonder Woman sketch, in having Wonder Woman reference. And like I don't think Linda Carter herself minded. I mean, she cameoed in that movie. Like, I don't think she cares. But like at one point, Piggy is like, don't you wish you brought your costume? And she's like, no, like, I don't think we clipped it. But like, it's just an interesting like way to approach this idea with all the superhero stuff. But she is not involved in it at all.
I wonder if it's a permission thing. Because
yeah.
I had that thought with Christopher Reeve too, of like, maybe they're just not allowed to, which seems silly in hindsight, but.
You know, they had a relationship, like both Superman and Batman appeared in early seasons of Sesame Street as like, as recurring bits.
But that's a different relationship.
But the difference here, too, is that she's done playing Wonder Woman in her real right. life, whereas right. the others were promoting sequels.
Right. No, mm-hmm. it's true. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. Just like to have them all in a row like this, it's just interesting to sort of notice it. And that the backstage plot this time is all about superheroes, and she's not really in that until the end.
I mean, I didn't really get into it in the bio, but I think she had not the best relationship to being Wonder Woman. Like, I think that she felt like the character ended up being objectified in ways that she was not really on board with.
Right.
And it took her a while to sort of make her peace with that. And, you know, in the last 10 to 20 years, she has sort of rejoined the DC universe, and she's appeared on Smallville and on Supergirl and in the Wonder Woman sequel, and has sort of embraced that. But it took a while for her to kind of make her peace with it and realize that, like, this is part of her legacy. And I think that what we're seeing here is a little bit of that discomfort, maybe.
Yeah. I've worked with several actors who were forever associated with a single role, and, you know, all of the ones who I know, like, they're all very different people. They all handle that very differently, but it's weird. Like, it is definitely a weird thing, whoever you are, to, and in this case, become very famous very quickly and very young and be an icon. Like, that's weird. It's a weird way to continue living your life, especially after you're done doing it and you want to do other things. So I think, like, you know, no matter how nice she might have been about it, like, I can understand why she wouldn't want to do it on the show.
It was a needle that they threaded so brilliantly with both Mark Hamill and Christopher Reeve, where they did a whole goofy, Mark Hamill is playing himself and Luke Skywalker. They did a whole goofy, Christopher Reeve is here and he has superpowers, even though he's not Superman. He's just hanging out by the phone booth in case trouble breaks out. And Linda Carter, they keep mentioning Wonder Woman is here. And it's like, no, she's not playing Wonder Woman tonight. Like, they keep saying that. And then, like, the Muppets are in their own superhero costumes, which is fun and cute, but it's not quite as brilliant in a story way, which is why this episode right. is great, but it's still a little bit of a letdown.
I was watching the episode today. I was also thinking about how she was really let down by whoever her management is. And it didn't occur to me until I was reading the bio that, like, oh, she was married to her agent at the time and about to divorce him. Mm. And I wonder to what extent it's his fault also that her career sort of floundered here. Like, if I were her manager in 1980, I would be negotiating, I don't know, to get her, like, the starring role of the movie version of They're Playing Our Song or something, you know, like, and instead she's doing these, like, TV specials and, like, releasing singles, but not an album, and just sort of, like, at sea. And, like, she deserved to have a next step after Wonder Woman that she never really got.
Yeah. And, like, all of us were surprised to learn that she can really sing.
Yeah.
I did not see that coming, but it turned out she could have had a whole career being known for other things in addition to Wonder Woman. So, as we've mentioned, Linda is not playing Wonder Woman tonight, and the Muppets are overcompensating.
How to be a superhero. Yeah, it comes complete with a helmet, a cape, a red shirt, and an instruction book called Invincibility Made Easy.
I don't believe that.
Well, I'm doing it because Wonder Woman's on our show.
No. Linda Carter is on our show. She's not going to play Wonder Woman tonight.
Well, that's just as well. There'll be plenty of superheroes around.
What do you mean, plenty?
Well, everybody's taking the course.
Let's see. Lesson 2, deflecting bullets with their magic gold bracelets. Hi, Kermit, what you doing?
Oh, just noticing that this season has produced a bumper crop of nuts.
I really, really love that line. It does start to feel like, I keep thinking of a Simpsons episode where Lucy Lawless was on, and she kept insisting that she's not Xena. And then at the end of the episode, she, like, flies Bart and Lisa to safety. I don't remember what happened, but they were like, wait, Xena can't fly. And she's like, I told you, I'm not Xena. That would have been funny here. I have a lot of ideas for how this could have gone differently. All the Muppets are taking, or many of the Muppets are taking, a correspondence course where they've gotten these packets in the mail with how to be a superhero. And they're all reading these little zines that it looks like somebody hand illustrated for each of them.
The covers look like they were drawn on crayon.
Yes.
Yeah. It looked like somebody in the prop shop just made these in a hurry and had fun with it.
I feel like correspondence courses were a big thing in the 70s and 80s that were about to sort of sunset as the internet came around. For people who are younger and may not remember them, literally you would send away and they would send you like a book and worksheets, and it's correspondence because you would complete whatever they sent you and send it back to them for them to like perhaps grade it and offer comments and then send you the next lesson. And you could do this for anything from like learning how to draw to learning how to be an accountant. And it's a thing that maybe it still exists in some corners, but like by and large, this has been replaced by online learning.
I don't think I even realized that it was that interactive, that you would send it back and get graded. I kind of only know it as a joke, like the as a punchline of I learned to swim by a correspondence course.
They do still exist. You can, I'm sorry to report, get a Bachelor of Science in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics from Liberty University via correspondence course.
Wow.
But there are like Fordham apparently has some, like there are some real schools that do it as well.
Not just the imaginary correspondence ones.
Not just Liberty University, which is not a real school.
Mm-hmm.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. In addition to these little zines, they also have superhero costumes, which are suited to each individual character in a really cute way. Scooter has a cape that's the same green as his jacket, and Gonzo has like a little hood that with a chicken on his head, and Lou Zealand has a little fish on his head. And Fozzie's wearing like what kind of looks like a traffic cone, but it's basically a dunce cap, which is kind of sweet.
They all look like extras from the movie The Apple. Have you ever seen The Apple?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Meanwhile, it's a movie that was made in 1980 that takes place in the futuristic world of 1994.
Ooh.
Where basically there's like an American Idol style competition to determine whether or not we'll have world peace.
Oh, God.
It is like the most bag of coke of all of the bag of coke movies.
It's so yeah. Good.
Because here's the thing. So it was made by Menachem Golan. I don't know if that name means anything to you.
Nope.
There's a great actually documentary about all of the crazy shit he did. But he made like the He-Man movie and also the Power Rangers. But the whole thing was supposed to be some kind of a like Adam and Eve allegory. And there's supposed to be this like very expensive like 10-minute sequence at the beginning that took place in the Garden of Eden that had animals and all this shit. And then they like saved that for the end and then ran out of money and just didn't film it. So like none of the movie makes sense because the entire like setup is just not there.
Good God.
But yeah, the 1980 vision of what 14 years in the future was going to look like looked exactly like these costumes.
Yes.
Wow. I can't wait for the future. So, yeah, all the Muppets are just busily studying these little booklets.
This Invincibility Made Easy is some kind of crazy book.
Chapter 4, Vanishing. To vanish, it requires several minutes of hard work to achieve. Shazam!
Bending steel bars is simple if you have a pure heart and clean thoughts.
Swinging from building to building on a rope should be practiced, perhaps by starting swinging across a room. Ah, right!
That actually was a very clever setup, that when Fozzie decides to swing across a room, Lou Zealand is staring at the dressing room door trying to practice x-ray vision, and the book told him that if you stare hard enough, then you will eventually see inside the room, and then Fozzie swings across the backstage set, knocks in the door of the dressing room that Lou Zealand is trying to stare into. So everybody's convinced that Lou Zealand has developed X-ray vision. So that's fun. And that's about the extent of the plot. There are Muppets that are trying to be superheroes. Later, they try to fly and fall down.
It does pay off in the finale quite nicely, I thought, which we'll get to in the songs.
You know, I just want to thank you very much because this has definitely been one of the worst experiences I have. No, I'm just kidding you. I have had a fabulous time. Great. As a matter of fact, I think that we came through this with flying colors, don't you?
Oh, more than that, we got through it with flying Muppets. Yeah, right!
Will you stop that,
Tom? Also, so all the Muppets as superheroes are there in the outro. Super Scooter says hi to Super Rat, who's still here from the Christopher Reeve episode. So that's a cute callback. Also, Piggy comes in and like grabs Kermit and pulls him to the floor, not as an act of superheroism, I guess, but Linda Carter is just so delighted by everything that's going on in that outro. It's very, very cute. Also, a couple of runners this week. First, a terrible reptilian tragedy befalls the Muppet Newsman.
Archaeologists today discovered an ancient tomb more than 5,000 years old in the Nile Valley. An inscription over the tomb warned that the crocodile god Rizal-Evad-Gib, that's Rizal-Evad-Gib, would wreak a terrible vengeance on anyone who entered the tomb or even pronounced his name aloud. That's a ridiculous story. I don't know.
So we should mention, if you have not figured out that Rizal-Evad-Gib,
don't say
it. Spell it backwards. Oh, don't say. Oh, sorry. Oh no, a crocodile. If you read it backwards, it reads as Big Dave Laser. And Dave Laser was the, or David Laser, I guess they called him Dave, but the credits don't, was the executive producer of The Muppet Show.
Well, he was like the business manager for The Muppets.
So, alas, the newsman, eaten by a crocodile. Beauregard comes to Linda Carter's dressing room and tries to help her not say the word, which she needs help figuring out.
Oh, Wonder Linda, I have to warn you about something. No, no time for the nicey-niceys. Something terrible just happened to the newsman downstairs.
You're kidding, what?
Well, they sent me up here to tell you not to say this very dangerous word.
Oh, okay, what's the word?
Well, it's, oh no, I forgot it. But whatever you do, don't say it.
Please use no time for the nicey-niceys at work this week, everyone. If you can.
Wonder Linda. I love it.
Wonder Linda. Beau tells her that it's on the tip of his tongue, where she actually finds it and is able to read the phrase out loud, or just barely. Fortunately, the newsman just reappears, even though he's been eaten by a crocodile, and he takes the fall for her.
I bet you thought they were going to say Rizal Evad Gib, didn't
you? Oh, no!
Well, after what I went through, I thought it would be...
That could have been you.
It's just such a beautiful, chaotic moment. Like, they're having a nice, quiet moment in the dressing room, and suddenly the Muppet Newsman, with his hair askew and looking like he's just been eaten by a crocodile, shows up to get eaten again.
And then the two of them, like, do this really great take to the camera.
Yeah. It's very, very, very cute.
Yeah.
We mentioned that Super Rat is still here. There's actually a whole pack of rats hanging around this episode. And in the UK spot, Sam is compiling a list of items that he finds offensive about this week's episode.
Already I have 14 disgusting items that have occurred on this show.
Well, like what?
Well, first of all, there's one here. A possible romantic liaison between a frog and a pig.
Well, I guess I'm not very happy about that one myself.
Oh, Kermit, you don't have to lie. But yeah. Sam is offended by the presence of rats, especially this one rat.
What is a rat doing in the legitimate theater?
Well, I sent him out to buy me a chocolate milkshake, actually.
You let a rat touch your food?
Well, sure, Sam. That's the kind of place it is. You know, the chickens dance, the pig sings, and the rat goes out and gets me some food.
All right.
This really sounds like Kermit is just restating the whole mission statement of The Muppet Show for some reason in season four, but I'm not mad about it.
Yeah, the pig sings. And there's something just so wholesome about Kermit saying, I send this rat out to get me a chocolate milkshake. The rat could be going to get any number of things. But it's a chocolate milkshake, and I appreciate that.
It's so funny, too, that Sam was so appalled that the rat would touch Kermit's food. If it is a chocolate milkshake, at least that's in a container. It's not like he's getting you a slice of pizza.
Yeah, and not dragging it back with his teeth. And also, this is the same mangy, molting Sam that we've had in the last couple episodes. So, like, I don't know what Sam has touched today and left feathers on, but I'm glad I'm not eating it.
This sketch is also the first appearance of Gaffer the Cat. who is, speaking of mange, the mangy looking cat with an eye patch who will have more of a role in season 5, although I don't think ever really has much of a role.
Yeah, I think he's kind of just there. But today, Gaffer is one of the things that offends Sam. There's a cat with an eye patch. Not pleased about it. Kermit points out the utility of having rats in the theater. They gather the trash and throw it away in the alley. And then before Sam could see it coming, the rats have gathered him up and taken him outside. And Kermit yells back at them to bring back the clipboard, which is pretty cold.
This whole thing, I'm sure it wasn't, but it felt very improvised to me. Like, really, really just felt like Jim and Frank playing. Mm. There's something so casual about it. And did any of you ever see Puppet Up? Yes. Brian Henson's improv puppet show.
I was even more sheltered then, so all I remember is how horrified I was by all the sex things.
Yes, it was improv for adults, and I think they still do it sometimes, but they had just like a rack of puppets off to the side, and then, you know, it was a very, actually a very traditional improv show, except for the fact they were using puppets, right? They get their prompt from the audience, they go do, you know, and like mid-sketch, somebody would like get an idea, run to the rack, grab a puppet, join the scene. And there's like something that just felt like I could imagine like this scene with Sam and Kermit starting and like somebody just like grabbing a chicken and deciding to walk through the background with the chicken. And because of the way it ends, I doubt that that's what was happening, because it, you sort of need all the rats for that punchline. And but, you know, I don't know. I just like imagining them just fucking around and making this happen.
I mean, I think this is the thing that with most great sitcoms comes up, which is that when you have actors were extremely good at delivering funny material, you want to believe that it's improv, and it's right. Actually just very skilled actors delivering scripted material. This comes up with the Golden Girls all the time. People are like, oh, that was so sharp and that was so swift and it must have been improv. And they're always like, no, we're just very good at what we do.
Right.
It's just a well-oiled machine.
Yeah. But I guess it was that it felt less well-oiled to me, like in a mm-hmm. nice way, right? But it didn't, it's... We don't usually see Kermit or Sam like hanging out with each other in this way, and I guess that's what struck me about it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So the setup of this one is so wild that I want us to get into it before we start talking about it.
How long has it been since you watched a good old-fashioned human sacrifice? Too long, you say. Wow, watch this.
Mm-hmm. So we then go to a very Temple of Doom kind of situation that we didn't get any sort of disclaimer for. So maybe it's not as offensive as it feels.
Well, it's not
targeting anything specific.
Real, right. There's no specific
it's very,
culture that is mocking.
They're sure borrowing from some many cultures. It's hard to tell which one.
Yeah.
But the fact that there are no people probably helps. I mean, pigs are people, but they're pigs.
There aren't whatnot caricatures of people. They're just pigs dressed as cannibals.
Is cannibal an outfit? I thought cannibal is an action.
It's a calling.
You know what? I don't actually know if they're planning to eat her. Yeah, I take that back. They're planning to offer Janice as a sacrifice to an idol that has many arms and also has little finger symbols. So like most of the references here are South and Central America. Some of the instruments, like the finger symbols, are Middle Eastern.
Well, and like the, I don't know, I thought the finger symbols plus the multi-arm god read as Indian to me, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he has sort of the head of Sam the Eagle, so he's American.
We should hear the song.
Yeah, so this leads to the normal reaction to being sacrificed, which is Janice singing this.
I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. Do you need anybody?
I need somebody to love.
Could it be?
Anybody to love.
Really, I get by with a little help from my friends.
I had to clip the really. It makes me so happy.
it's my favorite moment in the entire episode.
It is so fun and Muppety, even if you're trying to figure out whether to be offended by it.
And the great thing is Janice's ruse works. She summons her friends to help, which is pretty clever. So yeah, so talk about the song. The song is With a Little Help from My Friends, which is a song that was recorded by failed skiffle outfit The Beatles on their little-known album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from 1967. It was written by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, primarily Paul McCartney, and it was written for Ringo to sing, written with a very deliberately limited range, except for the last note of the song. And it's number 311 on the original terrible Rolling Stone 500 Greatest Songs list. Sadly, it is not on any of the updated versions.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a great song. But, you know, that list is terrible. I'm such a vendetta against that list. Yeah, and a 1968 cover by Joe Cocker topped the UK singles chart. And it didn't chart in the US because it wasn't released as a single. But it was the theme song for the Wonder Years. So if the song sounds familiar to you, but not in this milieu, that's probably why.
I mean, the Joe Cocker version is so good, but also almost a different song. Like,
yeah, like I knew that version first because I was a child when the Wonder Years was on. And when I eventually heard the Beatles version, not so much later, I was like, how is this? How is this the same?
I heard this version first, I'm pretty sure. Like, and we were a Beatles household, but probably not Sgt. Pepper yet when I was five. But like, this is one of those core memories of The Muppet Show for me, that like, I associate this song with these visuals always and forever. I have certainly listened to Sgt. Pepper many, 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 many more times than I've actually, you know, consumed this. But like, as a small child, like, this really stuck with me. I don't know if they reran this episode a lot or if it just like lodged in there.
I mean, this song was included on at least one of the compilation videotapes.
Yeah, you said that all the time. I didn't have those.
Oh, okay.
I didn't have a VCR till I was 12 and I was not getting...
Maybe you went to a friend's house and watched it or something.
Maybe. I don't think so. Those were not a part of my life at all. But it's so good.
It's pretty great. And also the song is great. I currently have the sheet music of the song open because I've been learning to play this on the bass. So I can tell you that the bass line is pretty wackadoo.
Paul McCartney, man.
Somehow doing all these weirdo things that don't feel like they match the melody, but singing at the same time. How does he do it?
Chris, you talked about the scene and the setup for this. And I mean, I love everything about it, but especially like, so they bring Janice in, they tie her to what looks like a grill. Like she is about to be, you know, barbecued. And she's like, oh, look at these things. I'll play some percussion while I wait to be killed and eaten.
Well, I think it also speaks to her absolute certainty that her friends are going to rescue her.
Right, right. And that's sort of how she, but it's also because there's a pig playing the drums first. So like there's an element to it of like, I guess I'll join in with what this guy is laying down. And it's very fun. I actually clipped a little bit of it. Love the way that builds and the way you have no idea what it's building to, right? Like, this is a very famous song. This goes on for a full minute and 15 seconds before she starts to sing, and there's like, you can't possibly guess what's coming at all. It's great. I love it.
It's also very Enchanted Tiki Room pre-show.
Yeah.
Yes. There are a couple of things about the staging of this that jumped out at me, and I don't know if they're meaningful or not. One is that most of the male pigs in this sketch have the little like black beady eyes that background pigs tend to have, you know, like, and also that Dr. Strange Pork has, but not the more expressive eyes that Piggy or Annie Sue or Link have. But the drummer has those more expressive eyes. I don't know if that's meaningful or not, but it stuck out to me probably because I've been listening to the Fabulous Miss Piggy podcast and it draws your attention to those sorts of details. The other thing is that when the Mayhem appear to rescue her. At first, you only see Dr. Teeth and Floyd and Zoot, and they're like sort of sneaking in behind the drummer, but also singing backup. And it struck me as like, there's something off. Like, why is it only three of them? Is it because I'm used to seeing them with Janice, and that's why three feels weird? And then I realized, no, it's because Animal is also part of the Electric Mayhem, and he is in the sketch, but you don't see him until much later when he kind of takes out the drummer at the end. And there's just some interesting storytelling going on there, because of course Animal isn't really going to be able to do the sneaky part, but he is going to be able to do the drumming part. So I like that.
Yeah.
Also, this number is reminiscent of What Now My Love from season one, which, if you remember, mm-hmm. was Miss Piggy sort of being worshipped by Whatnot Muppets, who then, over the course of the song, kind of transform into monsters as the song gets increasingly aggressive. And it sort of turns into a pig sacrifice, potentially.
That's the one that looked like it was in the stock room of a Pier 1, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
It's a lot of pillars.
This feels a little bit like they're revisiting that concept, but like really leveling it up with what they've learned in the intervening years.
Yeah. And this Temple of Doom set is, they've really invested a lot of time and energy into making this convincing. This is more than just a lot of pillows.
And that idol puppet is
so good.
Incredible.
Really good.
Because it looks like it's stone, but moves like it's butter. It's
and it takes at least four people to operate.
Yeah.
There are three sets of hands and a head. There's a lot going on.
Sam, you know that human sacrifice number at the top of the show?
Oh, yes.
Well, is that kind of thing going to be going on throughout this entire show?
Oh, Miss Carter, I'm afraid so.
Good, because I loved it.
Linda, your number is next.
Thanks, Kermit.
Congratulations.
For what?
You are the next human to be sacrificed.
I just love her.
And she loves the Muppets.
She's having such a good time. Pretty infectious. So yeah, let's hear the transition into Linda's number, because it's something.
Linda, you know, about this number you're about to do,
mm-hmm.
Well, none of our band has rehearsed this number.
Well, that's okay. I brought my own band.
Oh, says a frog feeling control slipping through his fingers.
Don't worry about it, Kermit. This is one terrific band.
I feel like we're finally getting the shift of Kermit from manic and kind of an asshole to just exhausted and put upon. And I appreciated that line about control slipping through his fingers.
So if you think they said the word band a lot, there's a reason for that. Let's hear the actual song.
Once I went to hear them play at a club outside of town, I was so surprised, I was hypnotized by the sound these cats put down. When I saw this short, fat guy switch a band between his toes, hey, I laughed so hard cause the band got down and it finally reached his nose. Hey, y'all, prepare yourself for the rubber band. Man, you never heard the sound like a rubber band. Man,
you're bound to
lose. It's the Rubber Band Band, which was a big hit for the Spinners in 1976 from their album Happiness is Being with the Spinners, which is such a great album title.
It truly is.
It was written by Tom Bell and Linda Creed, who were a team who wrote several big Philadelphia soul hits in the 70s. Including You Make Me Feel Brand New, You Are Everything, Betcha by Golly Wow, which was originally recorded by previous Muppet Show guest star Connie Stevens. And other hits for the Stylistics, Johnny Mathis, a lot of people. And yeah, this went to number 2 on the Hot 100. It was kept from the top spot by Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night.
Ugh.
I only included that because I knew that it was going to make Adam mad. but yeah, it also went to number 1 on the Billboard US Hot Soul Singles in Your Area chart, and number 3 on Cashbox, and then it ended up at number 24 on the year-end Cashbox, and number 81 on the year-end Hot 100. I'm fascinated by the discrepancies between Cashbox and the Hot 100. I'm sure there's probably some explanation somewhere. Linda Creed also co-wrote The Greatest Love of All, which was later a hit for Whitney Houston, but that was a cover. I didn't realize it was a cover.
Hmm.
And the Whitney Houston version, sadly, only weeks after Linda Creed died, became a hit. And she died very young, at the age of 37. But I learned something absolutely wild about this song, which is the other guy on the team, Tom Bell, wrote the song for his son, Mark, who was being teased by his classmates for being overweight. And it's wild to me that the song was written to cheer up a fat kid. Like, I love that.
That's beautiful.
It is. It's sweet. It's slightly misguided, but sweet. But
it does explain a lyric we just heard. Like, the Rubber Band Man is specifically described as being short and fat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just have to share one of the greatest things that has happened to me in recent memory, which is when I was home a couple of months ago in Louisville for my grandma's funeral. My mom and I were in the car and we were at a stoplight, and we looked over and the song was playing on the radio. And in whatever parking lot we were next to, they had one of those inflatable wavy guys.
Windsock Man.
Yeah. And he was moving in perfect time to the song. And it was just the greatest thing beautiful. I had ever seen. We laughed our faces off.
Not dissimilar to what we're seeing on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is another like core memory for me, not so much of the song, but of the visuals of these Rubber Band Men who are so cute and so much fun. And I suspected when I heard it this time around that this was going to be another Baby It's You situation where, you know, the original would go much harder and be sort of great. And I was right. And I brought a clip. Like those strings, like the Muppet Show Band was very, very good, but there were, I think, five of them, and they would sometimes multi-track, but they didn't have a ton of time. And like, there's so much going on here. I've had a stressful week. I've been listening to the song pretty much on repeat because it brings me so much joy. It is over 7 minutes long. And so on the Muppet Show, this starts backstage, which like should annoy me because why is her number starting backstage? But it starts backstage with all the Muppets in their superhero costumes. And then she walks on stage and leaves them behind and is back by the Rubber Band Man. And this actually sort of makes dramaturgical sense because the entirety of this 7.5 minute song is, you guys, I was out at the club last night and you will not believe there was a short fat man playing the Rubber Band. And holy shit, you have to come with me and see him. It's going to blow your mind. Like, that's the entire song for over 7 minutes. And it's wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I only wish that they had not cut so much of it for this, because I could have watched Linda Carter and the Rubber Band Men for another 4 or 5 minutes very happily.
Oh, yeah.
What'd you think of Linda?
Terrific.
Yeah, how about that rubber band?
Well, make him into a tire and drive him to Pittsburgh.
We get a Beatles twofer in this episode.
I look at you all, see the love there that's sleeping, while my guitar gently weeps. I look at the floor and I see it needs sweeping, while my guitar gently weeps.
Mm-hmm. It's while my guitar gently weeps, which was written by George Harrison, and it appeared on the White Album in 1968. And this one is 135th on that terrible Rolling Stone greatest songs list, but it's on several other lists. It's 7th on the 100 greatest guitar songs of all time list, and number 10 on Rolling Stone's 100 greatest Beatles songs list. And Eric Clapton's performance in the song is ranked 42nd in Guitar World's list of the 100 greatest guitar solos. I really love this. It's very, very simple. It's Floyd sitting outside on a dark night in a busy city and playing. I mean, that's exactly the mood of this song. It was written by George Harrison after the Beatles returned from their infamous trip to India, where they studied with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, which was a wild experience that I hope somebody gets to write a miniseries about. I would love to write a miniseries about it personally.
Ooh, call Christy, everybody.
Yes, call me Hollywood. Put me in, coach. I'm ready. But yeah, I think this is, I love it when they just do something straightforward with a character like Floyd, who is a goof 90% of the time.
This is another song where I thought they could have extended it and done another couple verses. Like,
yeah,
this is really lovely, but it was over in a flash.
Yeah, I assume this was the UK spot because it was so short and so simple. I'm pretty sure this is the Macho Man set.
I wondered about that.
Lit very differently. And I mean, the whole mood is so different, but it looked similar. I just want to sort of shout out the Beatles anthology that came out in the late 90s. The album version of this song is weirdly very piano forward for a song called While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And on anthology, there's a recording that I think is just George Harrison and his guitar. I haven't actually listened in a while. It's actually very similar to this version, if you liked this version and want to hear the whole thing. And it's just really pretty. And it's actually, you know, him sounding sad with his guitar, which is what the song is about. So.
Although visually, is Floyd still holding his bass on the screen? I think he is.
Oh, I didn't clock that.
I kept trying to count the strings, but it didn't stay close up enough on the strings for long enough.
So maybe I'm a cretin for saying this, but a bass guitar is still a guitar. I don't.
But it's not the sound we're hearing, is it?
Well, there is bass in the mix.
Sure.
Some people really take issue with calling a bassist a guitar player, but now a string bass, an upright bass, is not a guitar. But an electric bass, absolutely a guitar.
Oh, this is true. I love this version of this song. This is the definitive version to me. I have heard the Beatles version countless times. But I have a whole playlist of Floyd singing because I love when Floyd sings. Some people may take issue with it, but it makes me happy and feel soothed, and I adore this version of it. If I were making a list of the top rock songs of all time, I would rank this version higher than the Beatles version of this song.
Where would you rank this relative to Floyd's version of New York State of Mind?
Oh, I like this song better than I like New York State of Mind. I like both versions that Floyd sings. I prefer to the originals.
I would rank this higher.
Like, I'd rather hear Floyd than the Beatles, and I'd rather hear Floyd than Billy Joel, whatever that tells you.
And I'd rather hear the Beatles than Billy Joel. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, all that tracks. Yeah.
I have to give a quick shout out to my late stepdad, who did not care for the Beatles, but when pressed, he said, well, While My Guitar Gently Weeps is kind of okay. So
Floyd singing Blackbird, also.
Yeah.
Chef's kiss. Gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Okay, well, that last sketch must have pleased you poultry lovers. So here's something for the sheep fanciers.
Clip that for you, David.
I'm choosing to believe that's because I am a poultry lover, not because you think I'm a sheep fancier.
We know you're a poultry lover. I don't want to make assumptions about your sheep habits.
Let's just hear the song.
We are little lost sheep who have gone astray. Ma, ma, ma.
Gentlemen songsters off on a spree.
This audio is just so delightful that makes me wonder if I was just distracted by the visuals.
Yep. It's great. Yes, in the presentation of it, there is indeed a wolf in sheep's clothing who is going after the sheep as they sing the Whiff and Poof song, which is the traditional closing number of the Yale Whiff and Poofs, who are an a cappella group who have existed for well over 100 years. The song was written in, or at least published, in 1909, The lyrics were an adaptation of a Rudyard Kipling poem called Gentleman Rankers that was adapted by Mead Minigerode. Minigerode? I don't know what he wrote. And George S. Pomeroy. And there was already an 1885 setting of the poem by Todd B. Galloway, who was not a Yale man. And they just slightly adapted it and did an arrangement that they published in 1909. And it was copyrighted a couple more times, including in 1936. So it's unclear whether or not it's in the public domain. I think in some form it's in the public domain. So shout out.
Took two people to write that song?
Go figure.
And yeah, so the Yale Whiff and Poofs, yeah, they're still around. And it's fairly elite. They're Yale seniors who compete to sing in this group their junior year. And their former members include Jonathan Colton and Cole Porter, which I thought was a fun little tidbit.
I did not know that, although I learned just recently that a few years ago, the Whiff and Poofs finally started admitting non-men into their singing group, which I don't know which I find more surprising, that that happened or that Jonathan Colton was a member.
I mean, single gender a cappella groups are pretty standard. I'm surprised there's just not like a lady Whiff and Poofs.
I think there's a difference between having co-ed a cappella groups and having the most famous group on your campus be single gender.
Sure. That's
right. Like, to be clear, I did not go to Yale. I just know who the Whiff and Poofs are.
Right. There was that show, The Sing-Off. It was a competition show for a cappella groups specifically. Ben Folds was one of the judges. And I sort of loved it. And the Whiff and Poofs were on it one year, you know, whatever Yale year that was that they went on the show. And they were as obnoxious as you would imagine a group called the Whiff and Poofs could be. And to be clear, I went to a college that also had a very obnoxious all-male a cappella group. So, like, you know, I'm not throwing stones, but or I am, but I guess I am in a glass house.
I mean,
whatever.
Here's the thing, is like a cappella is a certain level of obnoxious.
Right.
All-male a cappella is another level of obnoxious. Mm-hmm. All-male a cappella at Yale.
At an Ivy League. And
right, at an Ivy League.
And then Yale, you go to Whiff and Poofs.
Called the fucking Whiff and Poofs. Like, Jesus Christ, people.
They were so... Like, you could just tell just the second they were on screen. I was like, oh, no. And, like, Pentatonix also was on the show. They seemed okay, actually. Like, this is where the bar is.
The Whiff and Poofs also appeared in an episode of The West Wing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this song was covered by some other people, including Rudy Valley, who had a hit with it in 1937, and Bing Crosby in 1947. Bing, bing, bing. Bing. And yeah, other people who covered it included Elvis and Louis Armstrong, the Ames Brothers, the Statler Brothers, Count Basie.
Huh. I gotta say, I was aware that, I mean, certainly aware of the Whiff and Poofs and aware that there's a song called the Whiff and Poof song. But until this discussion right now, because I actually did not read ahead in the outline about the songs, like, did not realize that this is the Whiff and Poof song. And like, what a ridiculous song for them to have as their signature song.
Also, when a single singer sings it, how many sheep is that singer? Like, are they singing I'm a poor little sheep who's lost?
I think they're singing on behalf of the group. It feels weird to me that it's their closer, because I would sort of get it as their opener, as like, hello, we're little lost lambs on tour.
There's slumming no it at world in which 22-year-old men should be referring to themselves as little lost lambs, except in very specific kink situations.
Okay, so speaking of this wolf.
Yes, there's a wolf on the screen.
So these are the same sheep we saw last week. They're still extraordinarily cute. And then a wolf who looks like sort of off model for a Muppet to me, but is also extremely cute, wearing, he apparently has earlier has killed and skinned a sheep, Muppet, who was real cute when he was alive. Everything about it is upsetting. And then one of the sheep, a ram specifically, transforms into a superhero, and his horns are covered by the costume, which was a thing I thought was very cute. And then pulls out a gun that like looks like a science fiction-y kind of ray gun, but just makes the sound of a regular gun and shoots the wolf in the head.
I wasn't bothered by that. That feels very Muppety / cartoony.
There was something about it both being a gun, making a gun sound and not like a laser sound, and leaving a black mark.
That was the part that did it
on the side of the wolf's head that I found a little extra for the Muppet Show. There's not a lot of, there's like gunfire, but I don't think we've seen Muppets get shot before.
Oh,
we've definitely seen. I mean, we've seen Muppets shoot at each other.
That's
true. The rooster definitely got shot.
Well, that's true. That sketch is different.
Well, I don't know. One episode where the sketch where it was like all of the wars happening at the same time.
Right.
Oh, right.
I don't know. There was just something weirdly graphic about it. The fact, like, the gun, like, you know, shoots something black onto his head to make that effect. Like,
yeah. I didn't love it.
By the way, this wolf will not reappear on the Muppet Show, but he will resurface on the Jim Henson Hour as a character in Dog City named Evil McBad.
Amazing. He's very cute.
He's also in Muppet Christmas Carol, Muppet Treasure Island, etc.
You think the lobsters would share some of their popcorn with us?
No chance. They're too shellfish.
Oh! All right, let's end with something super.
I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange-colored sky, flash, bam, wonderful you came by.
So this is Orange-Colored Sky, which was written by Milton DeLugge and Willie Stein in 1950. The original recording of it was sung by Janet Brace with Milton DeLugge and his orchestra, but the best-known version is a Nat King Cole version from that same year that spent 13 weeks on the Billboard bestseller chart, one of the precursors to the Hot 100. It peaked at number 11. And here's a fun superhero connection. I found versions of it performed by both Adam West and Burt Ward from 1966. They are varying levels of ill-advised. One by Burt Ward makes William Shatner sound like Pavarotti.
I think the Adam West one is very charming in its way.
It is. It is. He can at least sort of carry a tune, but the Burt Ward one... Well, the Burt Ward one was also produced by Frank Zappa, so it sort of like lives in a like bizarro Dr. Demento-y space.
This song was also included in Natalie Cole's 1991 tribute to her father, Unforgettable with Love. And younger listeners have no idea how that album just dominated American culture in 1991-92, to the point where like the title song won Song of the Year at the Grammys, even though that song was like 50 years old. And because of that, that is the version of this song that I immediately associate with first and foremost, even more than Nat King Cole's own version. And if you like this song and you like this kind of music, the reason that album dominated the culture is because it's very, very good. And I recommend checking it out.
This is another one of those like core memories. And this is the one I had sort of conflated this with a different episode and also a different sketch in this episode. But like, this is my main association with the song, to the point where like I acquired a recording of it much, much later, you know, on a standard album, and was like, oh, it's that song for the Muppet Show. Like no other connection whatsoever. And I love this.
Should we talk about what's happening?
Yeah.
Linda Carter's walking through sort of like a city street, and all of the Muppets who are in superhero training make grand, flashy, literally flashy entrances at the appropriate moments. And it's very cute.
The first one to appear is Scooter, and she does this adorable thing where Scooter is behind a little wall and Linda Carter just like lifts him out by his armpits like he's a baby and puts him on the sidewalk next to her and then like holds his hand while they're walking along for the next verse. It is the sweetest thing.
You fully see Richard Hunt's whole arm.
See Richard Hunt's whole arm. She also kisses him on the nose, which is adorable. And he looks delighted. There's a bunch of really great editing in this because, right, there's that. I mean, yes, you see his arm, but like, right, you know, she picks him up as one shot. They cut to her sort of holding him, but Richard's still puppeteering him, right? So it's a new, you know, they've repositioned. You see her start to put him down and then it cuts and he's next to her. It's really nicely done. And throughout the whole number, because various Muppet superheroes are arriving in terrible ways and landing and crashing. So like, you know, Gonzo literally gets thrown onto the set, lands, and then they cut to him being puppeteered. It's pretty great. And I just clipped, most of it doesn't work in audio, but I did clip this.
One look and I yell, Timber!
Timber!
Ah! Flying glass. The ceiling fell in and the bottom fell out, and I went in a spin and I started to shout, this is it. This is it. This is it.
I don't know if you guys know this, but Frank Oz was good at his job.
Never mind that jazz. Listen, turkey.
What? And get out of show business?
So one more bit of show business tonight. The much-anticipated Wonder Pig.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about superheroes on tonight's show. So here is a story of sheer terror. When civilization is threatened by one of the most frightening creatures ever to roam the earth. Who can save us? Ladies and gentlemen, our own Miss Piggy, starring as Wonder Pig.
Wonder Pig?
A word of caution. There are scenes in this story which may not be suitable for adults.
So in this installment of Wonder Pig, Piggy and Link play a married couple, which neither of them comments on. They just kind of agree to play it. They're worried about Miss Piggy's ailing sister, who is played by Annie Sue.
Oh, doctor, at last you've come.
Yes, what seems to be the problem?
Oh, doctor, doctor, my husband and I...
Yes, dear.
We came home and found my sister in a trance-like state, and all she does is make strange sounds like...
It's almost as if she's in a state of shock. As if she'd been frightened by a chicken.
A chicken?
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Dr. Strangepork then asks, do you keep any chickens on the... Like, this is faded under other dialogue, but you can hear him say, has she had any cacciatore? what chicken is it that has traumatized her? And it turns out that this is a mixed media piece, that the chicken is a... live action video of a chicken, or a video of a live action chicken, that appears through the window, and it is enormous compared to the Muppets. So this bout of cluckitis is warranted. There's this giant chicken that's been pecking at them, scaring all of the pigs in turn. And then there's another one, or maybe the same one, on the roof. They think there's an earthquake. Everybody faints except for Miss Piggy.
Holy guacamole! Job for Wonder Pig!
I could listen to Piggy say holy guacamole all day.
Why I clipped it. I had a feeling you would want that.
It's beautiful. So she spins around, she transforms into Wonder Pig, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is a porcine version of the Wonder Woman costume. And of course, Piggy looks ravishing. Her curls already look great in the sketch, but then they have this added bounce when she's in costume, and it does pretty much look like the Wonder Woman costume with some adjustments.
Yeah, there's she's got a woman symbol instead of the W on the breastplate. And I mentioned earlier how cheap the Wonder Woman television costume looked. This is better. Like, this is a this is a really well made costume for one bit.
Yeah, they're not joking around. Unexpectedly, the Wonder Pig also has the superpower of growing enormous. And not quite as big as the enormous chicken, I guess, but she pops her giant head out through the roof of their little ranch house, and the chicken flaps away.
Get your head out in the cutter.
So now they've got a broken roof, even though they don't have a giant chicken.
Very Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, or very The Muppet Movie.
Also that.
It looks like she's taking off to fly, but then when they cut to the miniature, she's poking through it. It's very strange. This not the content of the sketch, but this miniature model set is another one of the things that is like burned into my child brain.
Yes.
In this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And right, because that's how they you mentioned that we see the chicken through the window, but we also see them through the window from the outside with the chicken. And you can clearly see that they have scattered chicken feed on the roof of this house to make the chicken go where they want it to. But it's a beautiful little model. And then they throw the chicken on it. And then, you know, they do the same trick in both directions with the window, which I think is really nice.
It's very cool. And then the giant live action chicken walks across the backstage set, which is also a pretty cool effect. And they didn't need to do it, but they did it.
How come chickens are getting so big on this show?
Well, chickens thrive on corn.
Oh. So at the beginning of the episode, we said we would check in at the end to see if this discussion swayed any of our opinions about where this lands in the canon of The Muppet Show. Is anyone feeling like it is more classic or less classic than they did before we discussed it?
I've talked myself into raising it a little bit. I'm not sure to what rank you from what to what, but yeah, there's so much iconic Muppety goodness in this episode that the backstage plot was the part I was concentrating on for preparing for this recording. But man, there's a lot to love.
Yeah, I mean, you're all absolutely right about the pacing, and you know, I felt it watching it the first time too, that the superhero bits backstage are a little bit lax, but these are like some of my favorite Muppet songs ever. And I find Linda Carter so delightful when she is on stage that I have not changed my mind overall, I don't think. Like, if I was going to recommend, like, these are the handful of episodes you should watch, like, this one would be on it for that reason.
Yeah, just before we play the final clip, another weird little what the heck moment in this episode. They go out on Statler in his own superhero outfit. He's Money Man. We don't know why. There's a giant shiny dollar sign on his chest. Sure.
Good grief, you've turned into Money Man!
Yep.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Muppeturgy. In 2 weeks, we'll be back where we belong with the Carol Channing episode. You can find us on social media at Muppeturgy or on the web at Muppeturgy.com. You can buy our merch at Muppeturgy.com/store. Our theme music was composed and performed by Christy Bauer. Our show logo was created by Todd Brian Backus. And this episode was edited by me, David Lund.
I'm just going to skip movies because they're boring.